That's not
All lines are now bridged.
Good morning,
Thank
everyone.
You.
Welcome to the TEFCA Task Force. We will go ahead and get started with a brief roll call. John Kinski.
I'm here.
Arian Malik.
Good morning.
Do we have Carolyn Peterson yet? Okay. Aaron Meary.
Good morning.
Cheryl Turney. I believe she's going to be late. Sasha Termock.
Hello.
Steve Reedy. Cynthia Fisher.
Present.
Anil Jain.
I'm here.
Do we have Mark Roche? Seema. Andy Trescott. Denise Webb. David McCauley. Mark
here.
Savage.
Good morning.
That was David and Mark, correct?
Yes.
Mark's here.
And
David's
Noah
here.
Mark?
Noah? I'm here. I'm Grace? Here today.
Grace Rowe?
Here.
Laura Kahn?
Here.
Great. All right, John and Arian, I'll turn it over to you.
Okay, thank you. And to get us started, we are picking up on the matrix, and I should have asked before, is it possible to display that, the matrix? And we are working through our Tier 1 and Tier 2 issues that we identified on earlier calls. We left off, and where we'll pick up today, with Meaningful Choice, which is, well, it doesn't matter what page it's on because it'll be displayed on the screen. And if you can make that any bigger, that would be great.
Right, can you guys see my screen, the discussion matrix?
We
okay.
can see the screen. It's just a little small. Oh,
okay.
Much better.
Yeah, and so the sections for Meaningful Choice, if people want to look at their documents, is 2.2.3, 7.3, and 8.3.
Okay, so let me begin by, I tried to put this in RAM for myself earlier, and with the ONC please checking that I don't mislead anyone, Meaningful Choice is expected, as described in TEF 2, is an all or nothing request expressed by an individual to the entity that it has a direct relationship with. And it's a request that their information not be used in any future exchange purpose transactions, but that their information that was transacted earlier can continue to be used, but only for things identified by exchange, I'm sorry, but only for exchange purposes. I have some questions related to that one. And that if a meaningful choice request is made by an individual, they can make that request to a participant member, a participant, or a QHIN, and it's expected that that request be communicated up and down the network so that it is honored across the QHIN exchange network. So let me pause there and ask if I screwed anything up in the process or if that's largely correct.
Yeah, that sounds correct, John. I think that's one clarification I would make is that they can ask whoever they have the direct relationship with. So that can be either the QHIN participant or participant member, but they do have to have the direct relationship with the individual. So they can't just go knocking on anybody's door that they've never spoken to and exercise their meaningful choice.
Okay. Thank you. And so I, one of the questions, let's focus on the matrix document before I start asking things that I started thinking about. Exceptions for things like treatment, I wasn't aware of there being, if you are exercising your meaningful choice to request that your information not be shared, that's it. So it will not be shared for any exchange purposes. There aren't exceptions for treatment, if I understood that question.
Correct. It's an all or nothing opt out of the network. So currently, as drafted, there are no exceptions.
And similarly, for the second bullet, meaningful choice as it relates to sensitive information, as you just articulated, there currently isn't anticipated any specific granular choice. It's all or nothing. So I assume that also addresses that particular question. But I wanted to ask the since this made the list for discussion, inquire with the task force if anyone wants to weigh in, clarify, or comment.
Hey, John, it's Andy. Quick question. How does that line up with the consents and the conveying of consents as were talked about with information?
How does it line up with the consents or conveying of consents? Is that the question?
Yeah, because we have, four different definitions of consent, and I can see that someone might say that they don't want to have their full health information shared at some point in the future. That's fine. But then what about their consent status and the four different types of consent status? Will that also then be embargoed, or how does that work?
Yeah, as I recall, I think it was Zoe last time that had some very intelligent comments on consent that I couldn't possibly have made myself. Can anyone help with Andy's question?
Sure, I'll give it a shot. So I think, Andy, what you're referring to, like a local consent or like a specific type of consent that's required through any other kind of applicable law. So like, I guess, for example, if it's like an opt-in state, like Rhode Island, for example, that, you know, the opt-in consent would have to be held by also by the entity that has the direct relationship with the patient. And so the provider, if I went to see a provider in Rhode Island, it would be the provider's responsibility to obtain and maintain, you know, that opt-in consent for Rhode Island specifically. That's separate from the meaningful choice, the exercise of meaningful choice, which would also be held by the entity that has a direct relationship with the patient. But meaningful choice would be, you know, sort of broader. It's a separate thing that is specifically for the use and disclosure of all EHIs through the TEFCA network.
Yeah, I just want to point out, John, that there's a pretty deep queue right now, and I think it's Laura, myself, Noam, Mark, and David in order.
Oh, let's go there. Thank you. I'm sorry. Who was first?
Laura.
Laura.
Hi.
Please.
Hi. Good morning, Laura Kahn from CDC. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Great. So I just wanted to ask, based on the exceptions comment, just to point out that reporting to public health when required by law at a state or local level can't be opted out of, and I wonder how that fits in with this meaningful choice from an individual level.
Sure, I should have mentioned. Sorry, John, go ahead.
Go ahead, Zoe.
I should have mentioned that, right, there's no exceptions aside from anything that's required by applicable law. Applicable law always comes first, yeah.
Okay, thanks, Zoe.
Okay, was it Mark next? Oh, I'm sorry, no.
I was next in the queue.
Okay.
Just in general, as a general policy matter, this seems like it's something that we should be addressing in the MRTCs less specifically. So I think it's appropriate in the MRTCs to raise the notion of meaningful choice as expressed by the Privacy and Security Tiger Team. And in there, the notion of meaningful choice was to get away from notion of opt-in and opt-out as the only two spectra, and really to focus on meaningful participation and patient participation. And so the way in my head the MRTCs should work is requiring of the RCE to establish appropriate flow-down terms that obligate participants and participant members to provide appropriate meaningful choice as an affirmative obligation. But the details about some of the stuff that we're debating about whether it's all in, all out, whether there's exceptions for sensitivity, how to inform people about aspects that they can't opt out of, really should not be the matter of the MRTCs. And then as a specific aspect of a problem that can get raised in this situation, I forget what state it was. I think it might have been Minnesota, but don't quote me on that, where when you followed the rules, it was hard to maintain the consent status, and also hard because you couldn't, patients could opt out of existing, for example, in a record locator service. Now, I understand in this case, the meaningful choice is for participation in QHIN to QHIN exchange and does not relate to the local choices they've already made for whatever HIN that they're participating in that is enabling QHIN to QHIN exchange. But again, just a note that the more detailed we get this, the more we run into some potentially thorny holes, like if a patient is opted out, how do we maintain their status or report back, hey, I've got some information, but I can't deliver it because, and those kinds of things that are generally practices here. So again, just a plea for this one to pull it out of the MRTCs in the level of granularity it has, and instead express policy goals relating to providing patients specific and actionable information and choice relating to the kinds of information flows that happen through the TEF and through QHINs.
Thank you, and I think I agree with all that. But I wanted to make sure I'm not misunderstanding something, and I don't think this is what you implied. But my understanding, ONC, please clarify that a request for meaningful choice made at any level in the tree has to go up and down. So if you request an individual makes a request at a participant level, they have to share that up to their QHIN, who shares it across to the other QHINs, but also down to their participant members, because it's expected to be, for exchange purposes, honored across the network. Is that correct?
That sounds like a Zoe question.
Yeah, sorry, I'm just grabbing the language.
It just says
up to the QHIN. It doesn't specify that it needs to be exchanged all the way down to the participants and participant members, so it stops at the QHIN.
Okay, so in as much as, but it also appears in 7.3 and 8.3. So
yep.
just help me.
Right, so it appears, so if a participant member in 8.3 received the request for meaningful choice, they would have to send that up to the participant in the QHIN. And same if the participant got the request, they would have to send it up to the QHIN, but the participant doesn't have to send it down to the participant member. It just goes up to the QHIN.
Okay, and so that would be true of when the QHIN then communicates it to the other QHINs. They're like, okay, got it, won't share this person, won't transact this person's data, but they're not obligated to share it down through their participants and participant members either.
No, there's no language obligating them to share it down to their participants and participant members. But I guess ideally it would stop at the QHIN. So if they did receive something from one of their participants or participant members, they would know not to continue it on.
Okay, so I want to get to the people in the queue, but I just want to put an asterisk on that one that maybe this is a fairly minor possibility, but this is one of my questions was, it seems that that person might get care or have encounters with others in TEFCA who might be in completely different QHIN chains who wouldn't be aware of their request not to transact. I guess it would get no farther than their QHIN.
Great.
Okay. All right. Noam.
Hi. I wanted to thank Laura for drawing out that that public health point, but there's another subtlety that concerns me with this sort of all or nothing aspect of this, and it's a concern that in jurisdictions where patients can opt out of public health submission, they may find through this all or nothing that they are opting out, because it just goes along with it, of public health registry inclusion when they might not really mean to, right? That it's sort of the baby getting thrown out with the bathwater. So I have some concerns about that patients might not really understand the implication of all or nothing. That make sense?
It does. Absolutely. I think that's true of the concept of opt-out of health information exchange or whatever you want to call it in general. I agree with you. Thank you for bringing that point up. David McCauley, and then I want to acknowledge that Andy has his virtual hand up. So, David, you're up. I'm sorry.
Mark Savage has his hand up.
My fault. Mark Savage.
No worries.
It's a virtue of my ineptitude, and every time the hand goes down, the list bumps. It's my fault. Mark, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So two quick points, and actually a question. I'm not sure that I understand how sensitive information, that sort of those kinds of information that are treated differently by particular state and federal laws are being handled here. And I'm asking that question because they are applicable law, sort of like public health. There is a degree of granularity. So I want to ask the broader question of why we're not able to build, or why we are not choosing to build in a level of granularity around around meaningful choice here, which would solve a good number of the problems that we're here talking about. So I want to raise that as an issue, and also to raise some concern about the notion that if one exercises meaningful choice, nonetheless, anything previously disclosed before that exercise continues to be used and disclosed for an exchange purpose. And that is out of whack with what most people expect. They expect that when they say no more, that it's no more going forward, and they're going to discover that that's not what it meant. And that's not what most people are going to be thinking. So I think it's a big issue worth talking through. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's spend a moment on that. I had a related question. Let me first give the ONC an opportunity to speak to the rationale. Was that a presumption? Was the rationale behind the prospective meaningful choice a matter of feeling that was the most realistic to implement, or was there some other thinking?
Yes, I believe it's a matter, it was a matter of the standards that are available and mature today for communicating such consent for, like, through network-to-network exchange. And the reality of being able to do so and to I guess, being able to do the, you know, right to be forgotten.
I wanted to, well, and I guess it's, you say right to be forgotten. It seems like it's a right to, it's not a right to be forgotten in the sense that all of the information that's previously shared continues to be shared. It's a right to be, well, I don't know what to call it. I also wanted to raise the, if I'm understanding, the unintended consequence of the fact that you say, okay, so meaningful choice, I'm exercising my meaningful choice, so I understand that in the future, my data won't be transacted for exchange purposes, but my data that was shared previously can be exchanged for, shared for exchange purposes, but nothing else. Well, given that the QHINs have the right to use the data for exchange purposes and other stuff that isn't prohibited by law, et cetera, it seems that they have to now say, okay, so wait a second, I'm a QHIN, I can no longer transact this person's data going forward for any exchange purposes, and I can't use any of the data that I already have for these things I was using it for other than exchange purposes. That sounds like it's going to get a little complicated.
So this is Catherine. I just wanted to add a little bit to what Zoe shared. Some of the other kind of additional background on this is similar to how a HIPAA individual authorization currently works around the right to revoke. So some of the thought was that, you know, to the extent, you know, under HIPAA, to the extent a covered entity took reasonable steps or there were, you know, reasonable reliance on a valid authorization, you know, that's kind of where some of the thought is as it relates to this, the meaningful choice aspect, if that's at all helpful.
Yeah, I'm sorry if I missed it as it went by. You're not revoking an author, so you've authorized a QHIN to use your information for an express purpose, and it goes through date, whatever. Is exercising your meaningful choice revoking that authorization or not?
Yeah, like I said, I didn't mean necessarily to mix the two topics. I guess the question earlier was kind of what was the policy thought process behind some of the conversation and the language around the right to revoke or the right to make a meaningful choice. It's definitely not a parallel, but the thought is that similarly under HIPAA, when there is the permission that is given, if there's a person exercising the meaningful choice, I thought the conversation was really around or what we were discussing had to do with you know, using the data in the future or not, if I understood kind of one of Mark's
correct
comments.
Correct.
So that's kind of where
the
policy thought process was.
Okay, I think we do get into that nuance rather quickly, though, because one of my questions was if the patient has authorized their data to be used for, so the QHIN has data from the past. The patient has authorized their data for some use that's outside the exchange purposes, but then they exercise their meaningful choice, does that necessarily void that authorization?
It's a great question. How I understand your question is, is an individual exercising their meaningful choice the same as revoking their individual authorization?
In that case, then it's pretty nitpicky.
It's a great question. I'm not sure that that is explained in the MRTC.
Okay, thank you. We'll capture it. So I'm sorry. I want to get back to being careful. David McCauley and then Andy.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
We can.
Okay, good. I wasn't sure I was connecting. I think that my biggest concern is that this is a very under-specified set of requirements that has just a gazillion complications, not the least of which is that there aren't any good technical means to achieve it that have been tested at any kind of scale that we're talking about here. So there needs to be, I think, some awareness that a lot of this will have to be fleshed out going forward with the RCE and the stakeholders for any kind of practical implementation. So the degree to which the policy goals can be clarified and the technical goals left open, it'll help. But as just this little discussion about, right to be forgotten, retrospective kinds of things raises, this is a very underspecified set of requirements, which will lead to a lot of confusion in implementation. One is, so the pause on that, just general caution. Then second point, I think it might help going forward to think about rules that would apply to participants, well, to actors who are data reposers, who actually have patient data in their databases versus actors who are querying and forwarding and moving data around. And because the rules about somebody who says, I want to choose not to have the network pass my data around, it's pretty clear what that would mean to actors who are just moving data. They would stop moving that data. It's a lot less clear to me what it means to an actor who actually already has data about that patient in their database, particularly if that actor is a provider who has used that data for treatment decisions. In general, once a provider has incorporated data from the outside world into their local EMR by way of one or more of the various kinds of interfaces and interoperability tools that exist today, the expectation is that they will keep that as a legal part of their record because they will have used it to make treatment decisions. So that data is sort of unforgettable data. Data that's being reposed in, say, a regional HIE that has not yet been incorporated or is not inherently a part of an EHR, maybe there's a different rule there so that you could say the right to be forgotten says that data hasn't been incorporated by a provider providing treatment, so it can be turned off or removed. All that's just to say this is a whole lot more complicated than these rules here or these proposals here cover. And that coupled with the lack of any good technical means to achieve it that have been tested at any kind of scale makes me really cautious, urging caution about the degree to which this is pushed on to the QHINs as they evolve.
Thank you. As I was reading and thinking about it, I think I was appreciating, perhaps not to the level that you just described it, the nuance that was being created, and I'll just throw onto that pile that the definition of meaningful choice that appears on my copy, it's page 35, implies that it's a revocable, which means you can turn it, that your information sharing can be on, that you can turn it off, and you can turn it back on again, and so that's just amplifying, I think, some of the complexity that you're alluding to. Andy, finally, and then we'll go back to Mark. Andy, you still there? I think I waited long enough that we lost Andy. Mark Savage.
Thanks. Back to David's point, just to be clear about my question, I think when information has been taken in before an exercise of meaningful choice, there's a general expectation that you can't delete it. The concern is the provision for ongoing disclosure and use, which means that's what I was saying I don't think is in the expectations of most patients and consumers across the board. So my comment was not about fact that it remains a part of the business record. The second thing I forgot to say is, I guess it's a question, is there a provision for re-opting in? That does happen.
people exercise meaningful choice to opt out and then change their minds again. It's good practice to have a process for that. I don't know if we've got one in here.
Thanks, Mark. Yeah, so there's no process, but as John just pointed out in the definition of meaningful choice, it does say that it's revocable on a prospective basis if the individual gives written notice.
I just want to go on record as saying that talking about meaningful choice as equivalent to opt-in or opt-out actually is counter to the notion of meaningful choice, which is about the process of patient participation information exchange. And making sure that people are you know, clearly understand what's happening to their data and have reasonable means to exert control over it. So I think it's somewhat dangerous to refer to a meaningful choice as equivalent to an authorization decision, a consent decision, or an opt-in, opt-out decision. Meaningful choice is the process, and then there's a decision. Some of those decisions, as I think we previously discussed, are not achievable. Because
I agree with Arianna, and apologies if I messed all of that up. Yes, the focus is on meaningful, and that's about the process.
But it has to be doable at some point, or it's not meaningful. Right? It doesn't mean anything if the words don't actually cause something to change. It's not very meaningful if it's just talking. Hey, this is David. I jumped in.
Yep, go
ahead. I just wanted to respond to Mark's clarification, and I thought it was a good point. But to just talk about how subtle this stuff gets, you know, a provider who became aware of a patient's drug allergy through the network and chooses not to use a certain drug may wish to communicate that onward, even if the patient subsequently says, I want to be off the network. So, you know, previously encountered information will affect care going forward in irrevocable ways, and appropriately so. So if the data is incorporated in a treating provider's record, it's going to be really hard to forget it in any kind of sensible or meaningful way, not to make a pun on meaningful there. On the other hand, a research database, we've covered research isn't one of the use cases here, but a regional repository that has just been, you know, building up a local copy, it makes a lot more sense maybe to think of not disclosing that any further, even though someone may have looked at it in the past, because it hasn't been incorporated into a treating physician's justification for their decision making. My point, I guess, is this stuff is really, really subtle, and the current specifications just don't cover enough detail to lead to a clear-cut implementation. And so either the details need to be a lot more granular, or there needs to be a lot more trust placed in the RCE and stakeholders to figure it out within some kind of broad policy goals, which is, I think, the way it's headed right now.
Thank you.
I will say just one other third, just register this thought, because it was actually kind of an exciting point. When we first started Commonwell, we proposed a model that would allow the individual to make sort of two-way decision or an asymmetrical decision around their providers that unfortunately we never actually implemented, so I can't claim that it actually works, but a step in the direction, I think, of the kinds of things patients want in the real world is the ability to decide which providers can share their data with the network and which providers can receive data from the network. And you could imagine, just to pick two extremes, you may enable your podiatrist to share data with the rest of the network about what they did to your sore toe, but not to receive data from the rest of the network because you don't think there's any reason for them to know it. And then your psychiatrist, you may choose to have them receive data but not share any data. So you can imagine inversions where that kind of control would make sense at a provider-provider level. We had a model for that in Commonwealth. Unfortunately, it was never implemented at scale, so I don't know how well it would work. I do know that most patients will be confused by any of this and will just check the box. So all of this stuff is friction. And even though there are a few patients for whom it's incredibly important, for many patients it won't be very important. So you have to make sure the system doesn't break down if you impose the friction on everybody and then essentially break the network. That's another thing we discovered in Commonwealth.
Yep. That again, just as a case study, we required an explicit choice and explicit registration process that include markers for that choice, and the technical requirement to collect and manage all that information ended up being, as David said, friction for exchange. And we moved back to letting participant organizations manage their own requirements in a way that made good clinical sense without requiring specific technical means to achieve them. And there's obviously pros and cons there, but to some extent, you're really trading off friction and exchange in ways that actually don't reflect patient desires versus making sure that we've got adequate and appropriate patient participation in these decisions. And sorry, I jumped in before Sasha. Apologies, Sasha.
No worries. I agree with your concern and experience. And I was just going to add another layer of nuance to David's examples. I think the use of sort of a research purpose and a clinical care purpose both make sense to me, but there are also even more gray areas. I was thinking of quality reporting as one in the middle, where while it might not be, it's, I guess, less clear-cut whether data that's been incorporated into ongoing quality reporting or quality improvement initiatives can be removed or no longer used, even if someone is changing their preference midway through a particular quality reporting period or after a quality reporting period is finished. And so I think I agreed with David's concerns and point that there's more complexity than has been evaluated. I just offered that as maybe an example of where the boundaries get particularly challenging.
Thank you. I have one question I'm going to sneak in and then ask Arian and ONC if we should be moving on to the next topic, or if we want to let the in the interest of time, or if we want to let the discussion continue. And ONC, perhaps you could tell me if am I just making trouble here, or is this an interesting question? Let me see if I can get this out, and then I'll elaborate if I need to. Does a participant member, or QHINs failure to include info from prior to a meaningful choice constitute information blocking? So information blocking is all or nothing. It's got some complexities. So I receive a request for meaningful choice, but meaningful choice, I guess, says I can use the data or I must use the data from prior. So if it's as simple as they can keep it simple and say, okay, well, we're just going to, pardon the use of the term, opt out this patient, then that's probably not a problem. If they're expected to include that prior information in future exchange purposes as a must, that might get weird. Can you help?
So this is Morris from ONC. I'm going to piggyback after what Catherine said and what Zoe said, and to give you some color or background on the policy behind meaningful choice before directly sort of answering your question. One was to give individuals notice and to inform them of their exercise, and it is their. For lack of a better term, their right to exercise a meaningful choice on where their data prospectively is going. So I'm just going up a little higher to say there were some basic policy purposes behind meaningful choice. One is notice. The second was that it would be prospective as opposed to retrospective. Because part of that is because, as Sasha mentioned, some of the data is already baked in to a particularly quality reporting, is already baked into a lot of databases, and we ONC thought that that prospectively it would be similar to HIPAA. There would be reasonable reliance on past information, but not. But once the individual exercised that meaningful choice, it could be the QHINs could operate based upon that individual choice. So those are the basic policy goals. Is regarding, you know, information blocking. You know, right now the rule of the proposed rule talks about individuals. There is a proposed exception for exercising consent. So I don't want to, information blocking is based on facts and circumstances, a lot of different factors. So I just wanted to put some more color around meaningful choice. I don't know if that directly answers your question or not, or provide some help on that.
No, it helps. I'm not sure it answers, and I'm not sure the answer is known. It might just be one of those. I guess I'm asking Zoe or anybody who wants to respond. Did the question make sense?
Yeah, the question definitely makes sense. So I guess to reiterate the question, if EHI has been used or disclosed prior to the exercise of meaningful choice, then does not using or disclosing that previous, that information, does that constitute information blocking?
Correct. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Oh, I just thought, and the second point I thought was equally valid, that one of the exceptions granted in the NPRM is the patient's choices. So it's not information blocking if you, as a provider, withhold data because the patient asks you to. That's how I read the exemption, and I think that would cover John's case.
Well, this is Morris again. In the proposed exception, part of that is obviously the provider has to agree to that as well as one of the conditions.
Okay, good point.
So with that and no more hands raised, are we okay, Arian, others, to move on to the thing that I just turned on to the next page? Hang on.
Hi, this is Cynthia. I have my hand raised. If you see it.
Oh, I'm sorry. I do not see it. But Cynthia, you have the stage.
So the question I have, and perhaps it's for Zoe to clarify, is, when you're talking about the prospective right or the ability for the patient to demonstrate their choice or articulate their choice to opt in or opt out, is that also showing the various ways that their health information is being transferred and utilized and the prospective places as well as the trail, the cookie trail or the audit trail of the provenance?
So the instructions for how to exercise your meaningful choice need to be included in the written privacy summary that is published by whoever, the entity that's providing the individual services. So the written privacy summary has information about, the entity's privacy practices, including the examples of the type of exchange purposes that they facilitate and who they can contact for further information about those, about the privacy policies. So that has some information. I think some of what you're getting at in terms of like the future use and who's going to be using the data, what's going to be happening with the data, that would come more with like a patient's approval after receiving, they have to receive the minimum information for if there's going to be like a future use of their data, that's not one of the exchange purposes, then they need to receive a written information explaining and detailing what's going to happen to their data, who's going to be using it, what it's going to be used for, auditing procedures, et cetera. But that's a little bit different than I think the use case that we're discussing right now.
A quick question on that. I've brought this up in previous calls, and we just now also are getting this from around the country, not only in Boston, but other places, where there's a vendor, for instance, an EHR vendor, whose software just has at the point of care a signature line. So that quote-unquote privacy information isn't even disclosed. It's not even on the screen, and so you sign a blank page. Oftentimes, they don't even have a laminated printout of what that privacy is or where that goes. And so my comment would be to protect patients is when it's buried in fine print or not even provided as part of the EHR vendors are even eliminating it from being able to be read at point of care. I think it's really problematic because it's like, here, this will be your privacy. It will include where it will go for research or for even potential future marketing purposes. Who knows? But the patient really doesn't have full information. And so I think ignorance is a problem there because that really does eliminate choice because we're seeing patients report to us that they're essentially encouraged to sign that blank line because we can't see you until you do, and that's your form that will deal with your insurance payment and your privacy. This is pretty consistent now on what's being seen, and so my concern is it doesn't really give the patient the ability to see the path or choose not to have certain paths and have control of the management of their information. So I just want to bring that to the attention and think that we may want to empower the patients with clear information and kind of stop this practice.
Well, and I would go ahead.
I just wanted to say I think that Cynthia brings up a really great point, and there are just one or two things I just wanted to touch on from what she said. So the first one is that in the definition of meaningful choice, it cannot be used as a condition for receiving medical treatment or for discriminatory purposes. And so I really hear what you're saying about, you know, it just being like a line item and, you know, the it has to be signed or else the doctor or the provider, you know, won't provide care. And so that's definitely something that we thought about and want to make sure that that doesn't happen. And then the other thing that I wanted to point out is in the definition of minimum information, which again, the minimum information is similar to a HIPAA authorization, where if the data is going to be used or disclosed for a purpose outside of the exchange purposes in the Trusted Exchange Framework and Common Agreement, then the individual needs to receive the minimum information, which has a lot information on like who's going to be taking the action, the specific purposes for how the data is going to be used, how long that's going to take, whether the EHI is going to be sold or licensed, and any privacy and security measures that are going to apply to the EHI as it moves along the chain. And we say in there that information in all capital letters cannot be used to satisfy the requirement that the minimum information be conspicuous. And so that was one protection that we had thought of, where we often will see these kinds of approvals where they just put everything in capital letters, but it's still really hard to find. And so we wanted to prevent against, you know, them just, you know, using that and not taking any other measures to make sure that the information is accessible and understandable. So any recommendations you have around other ways that we can ensure that that information is accessible to the individual, I think would be really helpful.
Thanks, Zoe. And I, as you noted, it helps me to develop my, I'll call it my TEFCA intuition, that I think there are direct analogies with the notice of privacy practices under HIPAA and then the authorization under HIPAA. I think these processes, as described in the draft, the second draft here, are going to feel quite similar. So to Cynthia's point, in as much as if we don't feel that patients are sufficiently informed by a HIPAA notice of privacy practices, then this is going to manifest some of the same challenges.
Yeah, and I would just encourage people to read the privacy and security Tiger team work on meaningful choice, and it might be useful just to publish it out to this group. But that was exactly the point, is, you know, oftentimes opt-in and opt-out become a check mark on a form. And that's what we really intend here is patient-informed decision-making, and not the mechanics. And the more we concentrate on the mechanics, the more we're going to get, you know, check marks on a screen or something buried in an NPP. I think David's in the queue, though.
I think these are all great points. I don't think the QHIN or the TEF will change very much in this space, even if it was implemented as it's written. It is a teeny tiny subset of the number of privacy practice notices that you will sign when you go see a provider that would be covered by this. It doesn't flow down. So any existing data connections that you have to other national networks, such as pharmacy networks or your regional HIEs, would be unaffected by these rules. This is simply going to affect the QHIN's ability to share that record to remote providers should you be in some remote place and need care. It doesn't do anything else, so it's pretty minimal. I mean, it's all important and valid stuff, but it's not going to take away the painfulness of going through a new registering to see a new physician and signing page after page of notices which you don't have time to read and which are written in language that's very hard to understand. None of that will be changed by any of this. So let's not overstate what will be accomplished here.
Good point. I'd also add that we're kidding ourselves if we think that a patient is going to understand what you just said, that okay, well, I'm constraining my information flow within the QHIN exchange network, but not in other ways. They're not going to understand that.
Yeah.
Right.
Hey, I would suggest that we move on to the next topic, because I feel like we've hit this one pretty hard, and we'll come back again when we have formatted comments.
Thank you.
So I'll take this one.
Yeah, go.
Yeah. So there's a provision around EHI outside the United States. Part of that provision makes specific reference to U.S.-based cloud providers. Maybe we're now in a world where there's a pregnant assumption that all exchange activity is cloud. I think tactically or kind of nitpickingly, I think what's meant is that, data both in transit and at rest needs to reside in the United States. Or, you know, that no data relative to QHIN-based activity will be held outside the United States. And I think that's a reasonable provision. The pieces of this that become more operationally difficult, and, you know, just a brief sideline note or set of experience, I've experienced getting patient engagement, clinical access capabilities delivered worldwide for, which by the way is another issue, for the DOD, and getting DOD SRG ATO, which is a set of acronyms, which if you don't understand what I just said, then don't worry about it and just recognize it. It's a pretty significant. And it made operating much more expensive and much more difficult. In particular, the need to make sure that we had onshore people doing all activities, even when it made more sense to leverage business relationships offshore. In some cases, there's a presumption that we have U.S. citizens doing some aspects of activities, or U.S. nationals doing some subsets of activities. And so the language as it's currently written, in my mind, is a little squishy. I would recommend making sure that we have, we first of all clarify that we're talking about data being held in the United States, held and transmitted in the United States. And then secondly, I don't know if ONC had some intent relative to, for example, support people being onshore or offshore, if that was an unintended consequence of the way the language is written. Or if the focus really was data, data being onshore and subject to U.S. privacy laws. And then when we get that clarification, then I will raise the issue of service members who are deployed worldwide, who may want to participate in the QHIN, and how the TEF contemplates that.
So this is Debbie.
I
would make a point that, sorry for the wind, that with GDPR or GRPD, one of the two, I know that a lot of discussion is about where to retain data, and I would think that you would find that many companies are for keeping some data stateside for reasons of working with international, but certainly we do acknowledge that there are, you know, State Department people or people overseas that actually need to have access to the data. So I think there's some recognition on both of that. That makes sense.
Get a couple folks in the queue.
David's in the queue.
And Sasha. Sasha's up.
Oh, so I guess I had a question. There seems to be a presumption in this that there would never be any exchange through a QHIN with another country. I guess I just want to raise that. That seems short-sighted to me, and I guess I want to raise that for consideration. I think of a model where a healthcare system has some clinics in the U.S. and some clinics across the border into Canada. And that healthcare system might be connected to current exchange networks. They might be connected to, in the future world, a QHIN. And it would seem unfortunate if a clinic located in Canada couldn't get data about a patient that shows up there through the connection to the QHIN if such data exists and would otherwise be there. I certainly understand the complexity of then trying to negotiate Canadian privacy law or the other privacy laws of other jurisdictions, GDPR in the European Union as another example. But I guess I think we maybe deserve a broader conversation about if we want to categorically prohibit this from going there with these types of provisions. I also, I think, share Arian's concerns about if a support person is traveling in Canada and tries to assist with QHIN technical support from that location, it doesn't seem, I guess, maybe wise to completely rule that activity out either for the reasons that Arian described. So I definitely think there's some complexity here to discuss.
I think we got David in the queue and then Mark. Mark Roche.
Yes, David. I mean, I understand the spirit of this, but it feels a little bit like requiring use of a bulletproof vest that only covers maybe a quarter of your chest. The risks are so much greater than where the data resides that it seems silly to specify that as a requirement and not say anything about anything else. Would you go ahead and say you can't use Chinese manufactured network equipment in your data center? You know, would you say something about, you know, verifying the port of, you know, the origin point of all requests, that they come from within the United States. This seems like a tiny Band-Aid on a potential gunshot wound. The very success of cloud providers proves that it doesn't really matter where the data is reposed. What matters is the network protocols and security protocols that govern network access. That's where the focus ought to be, not on where the data lives. I would focus on security requirements for the networks, data encryption at rest, management of the keys, who has access to the keys, verifiability of access pathways. Those are the things that will protect the data, not worrying about where it happens to be in a data center, I think.
Okay, we have Mark in the queue, and then John Kansky.
Hi. So let's say that a U.S. citizen is permanently moved to, let's say, Mexico for his retirement. Does it mean that that U.S. citizen would still be able to, A, request access to his data from Mexico through one of the QCANs, and second, obtain that data for further care in Mexico or another Caribbean country?
So the provision in 2.2.11 does specify that there's an exception to the extent that an individual user requires that his or her EHI be used or disclosed outside of the United States.
Okay, I'm gonna jump in with my question. Two-part, saying this does nothing to solve any of the legitimate concerns that have been voiced, but a comment on the regulation. Is there any value in 2.2.11 Roman numeral II that has the problematic cloud-based services, given that we've already said that no Cuban shall use or disclose any EHI outside the United States? I'm not sure. I guess I'm suggesting, is it possible to omit that whole paragraph and be clearer? And perhaps a more intelligent question or comment, part two, is this, I assume that there's, and this is not an area I have a ton of expertise, so feel free to chuckle if this is ridiculous, but I imagine large corporate entities that move data are already, shall we say, putting using EHI outside the United States, and perfectly legally. And when we create TEFCA, are we saying that the data cannot be used or disclosed outside the U.S. for TEFCA stuff or for any stuff that they do as a corporate entity? And if so, how in the world will they be able to manage that other than pulling everything back into the U.S.? And I apologize if that was already addressed earlier.
Well, I think Sasha's example of a health system that's split across the border is a really excellent edge case. DOD is and State Department is a really useful case where the data may well reside outside the U.S. And the DOD may wish to participate or be a QN.
An example I'm thinking of is, what about even something as simple as having radiology images read overseas, which have nothing to do with a TEFCA transaction, but then when that data, so now TEFCA becomes an active regulation, is it going to be practical? And maybe the answer is yes. To say, okay, well, when we're QHIN transacting, that data can't leave the U.S., but it's okay when we're reading radiology images and then managing that process. It just seemed slippery.
If you have transcriptions that are done in Manila, which is a fairly common practice, then you know what portions of a QHIN's operation, if they're retrieving transcribed discharge documentation or transcribed imaging documentation would be considered to be in the U.S. or outside of the U.S. These kinds of things that happen all the time are exactly why I think the task force exists, to provide this kind of reasonable information to ONC, just as a way of resolving this. I do think, notwithstanding David's comments, that it is standard and usual practice for information exchange providers who would seek to be QHINs to have their business operations and data centers, notwithstanding whether they're cloud or physical on-prem, et cetera, in the U.S., typically around making sure that there's clear legal jurisdiction over the data, and also to make sure, I mean, there are security risks to holding data overseas. To David's point, some of those security risks exist whether you want them or not, and holding them in the U.S. is maybe not the most elegant way, not the most impactful way of addressing that security risk. But long way of saying, I think the restriction to have a QHINs operations, technical operations, data at rest and in transit be in the U.S. is a reasonable restriction that I believe most HINs already adhere to. I don't know of anybody who uses an outside the U.S. data center, for example.
Yeah, I agree, Arian. It is reasonable because it's so common. I just want to point out that it doesn't guarantee much of anything.
Right. To your point, security risks and vulnerabilities. I mean, to give a classic example, my data is in China because OPR couldn't appropriately secure the data center that I'm 100% sure was physically located in the U.S.
Right.
So this is Debbie again, and I would, when you bring up DoD, I'm certain about how there is the government-grade clouds, and certainly even like NIH has installations across Europe and Asia, so to better understand how they align with those rules and regulations versus where the data actually physically locates. At one point, it was like everything needed to be stateside. It didn't matter, because if you're in the cloud, you can certainly go over the internet. It's where it resides at rest. And then the other, that a patient has the right to their data, and certainly somebody that's across borders that needs emergency access, I think those rules and regulations are already in place.
And TEF doesn't address any of those other use cases, like offshore radiology reading. That wouldn't go through the TEF anyway. And
why not?
Changing
why
any
wouldn't
of those
the
rules.
Why wouldn't a provider who does rad reading a transcription provider want to participate in the TEF?
I can't imagine they'd find any value in it, frankly, because they're doing piecework, but contracted BAA-governed piecework. But, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
In
data,
rad reading?
Go ahead.
Does that data physically have to move for the rad reading? I mean, there's huge...
Well, it moves...
Yeah.
It moves at least at the pixel level to see it on the screen. So any non-Tempest computer could be read and copied down.
Good point. But in theory, it's remote access.
Right, but disclosable data would flow outside the country. Yeah, the other thing is that no data lives in only one place. Most data, is replicated in many different places, so for backup purposes and sharding and for speed of access. So it's also not appropriate to talk about the place where the data lives. Now, you could say that all copies of the data must be in the U.S. I assume that's what's meant by the rule. But
yeah, and I think that might be the out here, is just to clarify, recommend that ONC clarify that the data at rest and exchange technical technical capabilities for exchange operations by the QN be housed in the U.S. and not introduce this weird notion of cloud providers that are distinct from on-prem data centers.
Agreed. Good point.
This notion of sort of viewing on the screen from an offshore location data that is TEFCA relevant is sort of goofy, but I don't know. It's sort of given me pause for thought about all this offshore stuff and what it really means and how precise the language really needs to be.
Yeah, well, I just point out in the real world that you go to the hospital and there's a transcription that transcribed report, you have no idea where it came from. And likewise for RAD reading, I think we've come with all these examples of really good reasons why data needs to flow across the border. And let's just make sure that we keep this thing tight. John, should we go on to
that? I guess we'd have to write a rule that says your browser cache has to be turned off if you're outside the U.S. because we wouldn't want that copy of the HTML to be on the local machine outside the U.S., would we?
Well,
not going to happen.
Real tradecraft says that you've got to leave your phone in the U.S. and keep a burner phone only for use overseas, and then destroy when you're done. But that's as we say, neither here nor there, and out of the bounds of this discussion.
I agree. We're ready for summary of disclosures. Do you want to pass the baton back or keep going?
Go for it.
Okay, so we're moving down the matrix of Tier 2 to the issue of summary of disclosures, which is a requirement under 9.5. I will seed the clouds a little bit by trying. I went back and tried to refresh my memory. An individual submits a request for a summary of disclosures to any participant member or QHIN with which they, again, have a direct relationship, a defined term. I was curious as to whether are they asking the question of the entire network. So let's start making this a question to ONC is, I have a direct relationship with a participant member. I make a request for a summary of disclosures. Am I asking every QHIN across the country and any participant or participant member, am I giving them 60 days to communicate a summary of disclosures? I noted that in the rule, it says for a covered entity, it's just like HIPAA, but for electronic health information, not protected health information. Well, summaries of disclosures under HIPAA are pretty hard as it is, and EHI being a different definition, that's going to be somewhat challenging. So let me shut up for a second and ask if I've correctly characterized that no matter where the request is made, if the individual has a direct relationship, they're kind of asking the whole TEFCA ecosystem. Is that correct? Or alternatively, are they asking for specifically disclosures made by their point of contact?
So this is Debbie. I think there was, I believe there's a discussion that participants in TEFCA may not be covered by HIPAA, and accounting of disclosures may be different, mean different things, but I do recall a conversation that accounting of disclosures doesn't necessarily mean, like accounting where the data has gone, that they're under, I'm not a HIPAA expert, but I do recall there may be a subclass of data that's not captured by that, but essentially we do want an accounting of where that data has gone.
So thank you. So Is it an accounting of where that data has, is it accounting of the TEFCA transactions by the organization with which the individual has a underlined direct relationship, or is the organization that the individual has a direct relationship with just the organization they go to make the request of their summary of disclosures that have been made across the TEFCA ecosystem? Let's start with that one.
So this is Morris regarding... Go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, Morris, go ahead.
Zoe,
go ahead.
So to answer your question, I think the notion was to give some policy background, it was to be somewhat parallel to an accounting of disclosures under HIPAA, under 164.528, and that if the notion is that if an individual requests a summary of disclosures in which it had a direct relationship, that entity would not necessarily have to go out to the entire ecosystem, but would have to, within their purview, provide a summary of content in which they had in the contours of the direct relationship. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, and that would be analogous to HIPAA and obviously much simpler to implement. I understood your answer to be the individual is asking the organization with whom they've had a direct relationship, with whom they have a direct relationship, to disclose their summary of disclosures. So they would get one summary of disclosures from one organization.
That's correct, and that was the thought behind it. But again, we're open to whatever comments, suggestions, thoughts you have about this request.
That certainly blows my mind less than the alternative. So I like your answer as a future implementer of the REG. I will take, and I'm just again trying to seed the clouds here a little bit. Follow up with a, given that, because I inferred what you just said earlier was that we're trying to do something similar to HIPAA accounting of disclosures, but then I looked up the definition of disclosure that's referenced in the rule 160.103, and it's broad, whereas under HIPAA, while the term disclosure is broad, the disclosures for which one must account is outside TPO. And if there's anybody on the phone that wants to correct me if I'm mistaken. So in other words, if you get asked for a HIPAA accounting of disclosure, you're getting sort of the stuff that's on the margins of what did you do with my data that wasn't the normal TPO stuff. That's what's in an accounting under HIPAA. So I didn't see that there was such a constraint on this summary of disclosures under TEFCA, so it appeared that it would include every transaction made by that organization, whether it be TPO or any other circumstances. Have I read that correctly?
Yes, you have read that correctly.
No, sorry, no.
I'm sorry. Wait, let me be really clear here, so I don't want to trip myself up. And Debbie, feel free to chime in to make sure we have this correct. Let me just sort of level set. And so for in 9.5.2, we lay out what the content of the summary should include. I don't know, Debbie, go ahead and chime in as well.
No, sorry. So I in 9.5.3, yeah, it's Zoe. So 9.5.3
yes.
Does lay out the exceptions for the summary of disclosure,
right,
which are the same as the exceptions that are found in the accounting of disclosures within HIPAA.
Got
so it is not required for treatment payment models.
Right.
Thank
right,
you.
So it's not exactly good. Thanks, Zoe.
Thank you. We have no hands raised. So
let me just understand, John, from my perspective, is also somebody who could have to implement this stuff. So my understanding, just based on this discussion, is the accounting of disclosures requirement is that a a HIN operator who wishes to become a QHIN must maintain records of disclosures that are beyond TPO and must make those accounts available to participant members who request it, participants and participant members who request it inside the network, and that presumably the intent here is to flag information access requests that come through the TEF. Is that what I understand?
So close. It's available to individuals that use the QHIN participant or participant member for individual access services. So the QHIN only has to do it if they provide individual or direct-to-consumer services.
So does the individual have to specifically request the QHIN accounting of disclosures, or is it secondary to the individual asking for their accounting of disclosures of their participant member, who would then have the obligation? I'm maybe just a little lost in terms of the
right. So the way the obligation is drafted right now, it's only the entity that has the direct relationship with the patient. So if it was the participant, the patient would ask the participant directly, and they would only get the disclosures from that the participant did. So the participant wouldn't be required to go up to the QHIN.
Mm-hmm.
We've been gently reminded that it's time for public comment if this is a good place to stop.
Operator, can you open the public lines?
Sure. If you'd like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 if you'd like to move your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
Thank you. And do we have any comments in the queue?
Not at this time.
Okay, thank you. So
we have 7 minutes late. 7 minutes left, so we could either let people off early or try to chew through the seven minutes for more discussion. Do we have an easy one next? Oh, no, we don't have an easy one next.
Well, we were going to talk about, I think we wanted to talk about auditable events in the context of the summary of disclosures.
Thank you. So can someone help me tee that up? Because from those four words, my light bulb's not going on.
Yeah, I think the context was that a QHIN, there's specific language around the auditable events that a QHIN must maintain, and we want to make sure that those requirements are in line with the accounting for disclosures, for summary disclosures. Here we go.
Thank you.
I think it's strange to refer to the QTF in the context of the MRTCs, because the QTF is going to change. So I'd recommend that this language be at the policy level rather than at the then make a forward reference to the QTF. Sorry, David.
That makes good sense to me. And I would also say that the energy ought to be put in defining the auditable events, and then disclosures can only exist in the context of an audited event. So the driver ought to be auditable events, not disclosures.
That's right.
If you don't audit it, you can't disclose it, and not vice versa. So we should probably have reversed the order that we thought about this.
Yep, and then we should make the point that the auditable events should not delegate all of the hard work to the QTF. but instead describe the policy of audit retention, what's audited, what's required to be audited, et cetera.
Yeah, and then you can debate.
So moving things to the QTF does or doesn't solve the problem?
No, so to the extent that there are important policy outcomes that a QTF needs to adhere to, those should be described in the MRTCs at a policy level rather than delegate the hard work forward to the QTF.
It seems to me that
QTF's going to change over time. Sorry, David.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think a modern, reasonable assumption at the policy level would be that every transaction that a QHIN or participant has with respect to a patient should be audited. And then the debate can be around exemptions to that and definitions of what subset of the data actually needs to be kept in the audit log. I would expect that if my data is flowing through a QHIN, I would expect that it's kept a record of that. I mean, I think any sane data implementation would do that regardless, but it seems like a reasonable policy goal.
Is there a audit retention goal here? Should we go back to the PDF? Is there anything lower? Huh. Okay. You got to audit it, but you don't have to retain it.
But you have to be able to disclose it for 6 years, so that's a backwards way of imposing a retention.
A six-year retention.
Yeah. That should be switched around and be part of the audit. And then you could have variable degrees of disclosure. You know, you must do the disclosure for up to X years, even though the audit log might have a different number for some reason, I suppose.
This is Debbie. That's a good reason to define exactly what you need to audit, because that's a lot of data.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah, I mean, at a minimum, the fact that a transaction happened, probably you want a little bit more than the minimum.
All right, we got two more minutes.
Wow,
sounds like lunchtime to me.
We're leaving off at the end of we're going to pick up tomorrow with CUI on tier two, and our goal for the call tomorrow, and we are in some of the lower tiers and we're picking up speed a little bit, is to hopefully finish out the remainder of the issues on the call tomorrow so that we can be drafting some draft recommendations to be kicking around as a task force by the next meeting.
Yep.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Thanks, all.
Thank you, everyone, and we'll chat again tomorrow.